Interview with Commissioner Annette Nazareth at her office at the Securities Exchange Commission, November 4th, 2005, by Kenneth Durr.
I'd like to start with your education, a little bit of background. I understand you went to Columbia Law School.
Yes, I did.
And I want to hear what it was like taking classes from Harvey Goldschmidt.
Oh, that's a very interesting question. Harvey Goldschmidt was certainly one of my very favorite professors. Harvey was and is an extremely gifted professor. I actually took antitrust law from Harvey and corporations. Interestingly, I did not learn securities law from Harvey. That's not the class that he was teaching when I was there. But I got to know Harvey a little bit better than I otherwise may have, because I was also a researcher for him when he was updating his antitrust book. So I have to say that his mastery of those areas was also pretty amazing. And frankly, I enjoyed the antitrust class enough to have considered being an antitrust lawyer, although in retrospect, I'm very happy I did not pursue that. But again, he was really wonderful person to know in law school, and it was a tremendous honor to be able to come to the commission and then have the opportunity to work with him again.
Sure.
And it's particularly thrilling now having what I consider his seat, in a sense, having been appointed to the commission upon his retirement.
So he used to send you out to the library to do research? Like
that? Yes. It wasn't really a very difficult task, because his textbook was widely accepted, and it was really a question of ensuring for the next edition that there weren't any additional cases that changed any of the analysis or the footnotes.
Okay. Did you go right into the financial industry out of the law school?
I did. I actually went to Columbia because I was interested in financial services issues. I'm not quite sure how that happened. There was nothing in my background in particular that would have said that that's where I would end up, but when I was at Brown, I was interested in economics, and I guess through my study of economics, I became interested in capital formation. I was very interested intrigued at the possibility of going to Wall Street and learning how public offerings were done, how the capital markets were accessed, and so through that interest, I decided to look for law schools that really would emphasize corporate and securities law, and certainly Columbia was at sort of the top of the list of schools that had that emphasis, and certainly given their location in Manhattan also provided tremendous access to Wall Street.
And did you go right into main bond regions?
No, I didn't. I did not start out in the securities industry. I thought, again, that I would practice law in the securities area, and wanted to get, I guess, what I'd consider one of the best postgraduate educations that I could get by going to a Wall Street law firm. So I started my career at Davis Polk & Wardwell in 1981, and went there to do corporate and securities work, and it was a really invaluable experience, because they had such a steady diet of interesting corporate and securities work, banking work. I was in the corporate department, and they used to rotate people through the three areas that they at that time divided their corporate practice into, which was primarily securities offerings, mergers and acquisitions, and banking, commercial banking, lending type situations. And so I rotated through all three, and actually spent, I would say, most of my time at Davis Polk on mergers and acquisitions work, which was very interesting.
Did securities turn out to be your favorite?
I actually did less work on public offerings than in the other areas. I did more of the lending work. I worked on some I worked on the Brazilian debt restructuring. I did some sovereign debt restructuring work. It was very interesting. I did more private placement work than I did public offering work. I had started to shift into some more public offering work towards my later days there, but for some reason, I don't know, luck of the draw, just the way I rotated through, I would say that my experience in the public offering area was probably the least of my experience there. On the other hand, through mergers and acquisitions, you do a lot of 34 Act work as well, so and 33 Act work as well. So I was certainly familiar with it, but not through straight corporate, public offerings.
Well, I was really intrigued by your first, the first company you worked
at. I see.
Because I thought that the Yugo was...
Yes. Yes.
And talk about bringing back memories.
Yes. Painful ones for me. That's right. When I left Davis Polk, I had a really, in retrospect, tremendous opportunity, very unusual opportunity. I was just turning 30 years old, and I was offered the chance to go to a regional broker-dealer named Maybon Nugent, which at that time was number 50 in the country in terms of equity capital. And I was to be their general counsel. So it was a fantastic opportunity to really take a pretty senior position in a somewhat smaller broker-dealer, but one that was nevertheless, well-respected, particularly in the fixed income area, and to advance my career in that way. And I learned a tremendous amount about the securities industry through that job. And I think one of the advantages in retrospect, it wasn't by design, but one of the advantages in retrospect of having gone to a somewhat smaller firm was that I really did do a lot more hands-on work than I might have done. I didn't have to specialize quite as much as I would have had I gone to a much larger firm at that point. And I was very lucky. I worked very closely with the managing partner of the firm and other senior people who really taught me a tremendous amount about the business. I mean, they had me right by their side and with everything they did, and really explained to me how the business worked. And so it was a really unique experience. But we did have a few problems, including the offering of the Yugo, which was obviously very difficult financially for the firm. So we weren't immune from the mistakes that are made by lots of people on Wall Street, but again, it was a really good learning experience.
And then you made the move to
Lehman? And then I made the move to Lehman Brothers. Maybon Nugent had been sold to a foreign entity, and so its business started shifting somewhat, and I think its commitment to the U.S. markets was also changing over time. And so I was interested in moving at that point to a firm that I thought would have a broader base of business. I think Maybon had been contracting. And I didn't pick the ideal time to move. I was 5 months pregnant with my, with my daughter, so it was with my second child when I moved. But I remember Tom Russo, who is vice chairman of Lehman Brothers, who I had worked with a lot when I was at Maybon Nugent. He was the chief outside lawyer at Cadwallader. And he brought me over, and as has always been his way, was very generous in talking me up with the traders. And when I ever showed up the first day on the trading floor, clearly, very far along in my pregnancy, they looked as if they could not believe that Tom had sold them such a damaged bill of goods. So I was very lucky. I just pretended that it we ignored the elephant in the room and just moved on. But that was a wonderful segue into working for larger broker dealers. There I was in charge of the fixed income legal section, which was really a great opportunity for me because Maybon, although we were full service, was really known as a bond house. So my area of expertise was in fixed income. Lehman's businesses were just tremendous. Many of them were, number one in their areas, including, you know, structured products and things like that. And so it was, you know, as I said, a great opportunity, and worked out really well.
So you came in to specialize in bonds?
Yes, I was the senior lawyer for the whole fixed income area, and at that time Lehman was number one in fixed income, so it was a great chance. So again, I was a somewhat smaller fish in a much larger pond, so it was a move well worth making.
And then the next jump?
And then the next jump was to Smith Barney. That was likewise a good opportunity because there I was brought in to be the general counsel of the whole capital markets division. So again, trying to sort of broaden myself back out and not just being limited to fixed income. I was made a managing director, which at the time seemed important. And so I would then be the senior lawyer over all of the sales and trading of securities and the derivative products and the futures. So
this gave you a very broad overview.
It was a broader overview, exactly. But it was also a very dynamic time on Wall Street because shortly thereafter, as you know, Smith Barney merged with Salomon, and then shortly after that, they announced that they were merging, you know, with Citigroup. So it was a very dynamic time where the job shifted several. There were several permutations.
Things were moving underneath
frequently, which is part of the, you know, it's a truism on Wall Street. If it doesn't happen, you're probably in a very unusual place.
Did you deal with the commission at this point? What was it like dealing with the? What was your impression of the Securities and Exchange Commission?
Well, I always had a very high regard for the SEC. It never, in a million years, occurred to me that I would work at the SEC or go there, but I had, you know, certainly a deep respect for the commission. I had participated in industry activities that enabled me to meet with commission staff primarily. I was active in both the Securities Industry Association and the Bond Market Association. And so through those efforts, I would work with other industry participants to comment on rulemakings and the like. I don't think I ever met a commissioner. I did have some interaction with the enforcement division, not too much, fortunately, I guess. It's funny, just the other day, as an aside, I ran into Colleen Mahoney, and she said that she felt like she'd known me before, but she couldn't recall the context, and it was that there was an enforcement action that very late in the game I got involved in with Lehman Brothers and had spoken, not in person, which is one reason why she didn't remember in particular, but spoke to her over the phone several times about, you know, how the order should be fashioned, that there was no question that Lehman was consenting and agreeing what had been done, but that the characterization of some of the activity I thought was problematic, and I was saying, and she said, well, I hope I was helpful. I said, certainly were. I recall that we agreed on the changes, so that was my somewhat limited experience with the enforcement division. Well, we had certainly had a lot of blue sheet requests, and we did have issues, but fortunately, I don't recall personally being sort of inundated with enforcement matters. I also wasn't in charge of litigation, so or the regulatory side per se at some of these larger firms.
How did you come to the attention of Arthur Levitt?
Well, that's a good question. Totally by accident, actually, I think. When I was at Salomon Smith Barney, I had the pleasure of working with someone who'd been chief of staff to Arthur Levitt, named Michael Schlein. And at some point in my tenure at Smith Barney, my husband started working in Washington. He was a member of the Federal Reserve Board. And so he was commuting back and forth to New York, but working in Washington most of the week, virtually all of the week. And so the senior folks at Smith Barney were aware of that and seemed to be looking for opportunities occasionally, just to be nice, to send me on little jaunts to Washington for events. So they very kindly asked me to represent the firm, along with Michael Schlein, at a charity event in Washington. I didn't have the heart to tell them that my husband was actually out of town that day. Did not serve any particularly useful purpose for me, but it was such a nice gesture, and I thought that it may, you know, in the future there could be other opportunities, that I accepted, and I came to Washington with Michael. And on the ride down, we had not had the opportunity, as I realized as we were talking on the plane, to really get to know each other and what our situations were. And that was the first that he realized that that, you know, my husband was commuting. And so apparently after our event, I went back to New York, and Michael made a stop at the SEC to visit his old boss, Arthur Levitt. And anybody who knows Arthur will understand this story. Arthur was very happy to see Michael and then sort of said, well, you know, what have you done for me? What have you done for your country? You know, I sent you to Wall Street. You know, I sent you back into the world, but you were supposed to send others, you know, from Wall Street down here to help me and to assist the commission, and you haven't sent me a single name. And so Michael, being pressed, said, well, I actually know of someone who is not looking to work in Washington at all, but she should be, because she's making her poor husband commute. And so Arthur made him give up the name and the phone number immediately, and the next day I was stunned, because I think Arthur called before Michael had had a chance to warn me. So I had a message on my desk from my secretary that said Arthur Levitt called, and the first thought I had was, there's no advice in the recent past that I've given that was either so important or so wrong that Arthur Levitt would be calling me personally. But it turned out it really was Arthur Levitt, and it was a cold call from Arthur Levitt. It was sort of, hi, this is Arthur Levitt, I'm chairman of the SEC, would you like to have lunch? and so I did, and the rest is history. It was very interesting.
Was it easy to make the decision to come to Washington?
It should have been easier. I really was a Wall Street junkie. I loved what I did. I loved working in the brokerage firms, being on trading floors. I loved crises. I mean, it was the kind of thing I'd go in the morning, and the first time I looked at my watch, it would be 5 p.m. I couldn't believe how much fun it was. And so I actually debated it quite a bit. When I told my husband, he was so obviously thrilled that it became clear to me that this commuting business wasn't quite as easy for him, perhaps, as he'd let on. He was extremely interested in my moving to Washington, but also made very compelling arguments about the value of public service, which obviously he was a bit ahead of me on. And you know, in retrospect, it's sort of silly that I wasn't more wildly enthusiastic immediately, because it is a tremendous opportunity. I did, though, frankly, have some doubts because of my own love of the dynamics of trading and the active pace on Wall Street, that that perhaps policymaking would not suit me, that the tempo of it would not be something that I enjoyed. And that does take a little getting used to. It's a different style. But once you're hooked, you're really hooked.
And so. You still get your moments of panic and crisis.
Yes, but not quite the same way. There's really more time to reflect in this kind of a job. Yes, I hope so.
You're charged with Arthur Levitt. At first you were an assistant, is that right?
I was senior counsel to Arthur Levitt.
You were senior
So I came in, well, senior, just meaning that I was one of the counsels in the chairman's office.
What was your portfolio? What were you supposed to do?
Well, I was really covering primarily the market regulation issues that came through the chairman's office. And what Arthur had was counsels that who would independently advise him on the matters that came to him, so that he would not only get a briefing from the division, but also to some extent a second look by someone who had expertise in his own office, who could give him an independent evaluation of what he was looking at.
So you were helping him triangulate, I guess.
Yes. Yes.
Did you find yourself generally in agreement with what Margaret Reg was saying?
I did. And frankly, if there were times that I didn't, or if there were times when I thought that, I had issues or questions, I would go directly to the division, and they were, very generous in either making changes or working through the issues or explaining how they got to where they were. And there was at least one occasion where Arthur thought that, well, gee, how rigorous are you being, because you always seem to have consensus. And I, in my own way, made it very clear to him that it wasn't that there was always consensus to start, but that my view was that it was far more productive to work with the division and get to where we all needed to be, rather than to tell Arthur that they were wrong and then be the big shot and try to fix it. I think at first he wasn't, I think he had some question as to whether that's what was really going on, but I think it became clear later that that is what was going on. And frankly, again, in retrospect, I'm very glad it was my style to do it that way anyway, but I'm very glad I did it that way, because once I had the opportunity to do the job that I really wanted, which was to be the director of market regulation, I was really viewed as more of a team player rather than somebody who'd been foisted on them, who had gotten there by making them all look bad at my own,
right,
for my own benefit, which was not the purpose at all. The purpose is to ultimately come out of the commission with a product that we're all proud of. So
that worked well, even if it wasn't a strategy. You were,
yes,
in a good position to move into.
Well, it was my desire to do that. I mean, when I came to the commission, it was not my desire to be a counsel to the chairman. I really thought that, given my experience, I wanted to have the opportunity to be a director of the division. That job was not available at the time I came in, although there was a lot of speculation that Rich Lindsay would be leaving soon. And I think he had given some indication to Arthur Levitt that he would be retiring in the next several months. And so, and Arthur did not promise me the job, but he said that I would certainly be in a excellent position to apply for it. So again, my view was, not some, if I was going to get there, I was going to be there by getting along with everybody one way or the other, so.
At this point, the Clinton administration had a freeze really on the SEC for quite a while. And I'm wondering if you saw the effects of that. Really, funding didn't increase much.
Well, I was at the very tail end of Arthur's years, and so I didn't have particular experience with what it was like before.
Mm-hmm.
So I really can't say that I had a personal.
If that was in the air at that point, if people talked about the situation.
I don't recall.
Okay. About the time that you went into market reg, there was some talk about you going under the CFTC.
That's right.
Was that serious?
Oh, it was very serious.
Yeah.
No, it was very, very serious.
Would you have liked that?
Well, I'm really glad that I stayed and that things worked out the way they did. Frankly, it was really an honor to be considered, and I was very seriously considered for that position. I think it really came down to Bill Rayner or me for that position. But the securities area is one that I knew well and was comfortable with. I had done work in derivatives, but I really was not as proficient in the futures, the commodity futures area. I think I could have gotten up to speed, you know, reasonably quickly, but to some extent, you know, the CFTC is a small agency, as you know, and the opportunities, and this was certainly Arthur's argument as well, the opportunities in the Division of Market Regulation were pretty vast. I mean, again, it's a question of, do you want to, obviously being a presidential appointee and the head of an agency, albeit a smaller one, would still be a tremendous honor, but the issues that Market Reg, you know, obviously got to grapple with and address in my tenure there were, you know, really tremendous, and I think that turned out to be, I think, probably in retrospect the better opportunity for me.
So Levitt was selling you on
that. Oh yes, Arthur really wanted. Well, you know, it's funny. I have to admit, I think on the one hand he really wanted me to stay. I have to say that I think it's fair to say that whenever you're in play like that, it sort of increases people's interest in you. I suspect it didn't hurt in terms of my getting the Market Reg position that the backup was chairman of another agency. So I think that certainly made people stand up and think, well, gee, she must really have something to offer if we're fighting over her, kind of thing. So.
Right, and it didn't happen too much later.
Oh no, it was all being considered at exactly the same time. It was very sort of a high wire. I mean, came down here having no idea what was going to happen with my career, other than, you know, Arthur Levitt had convinced me to come down, and then suddenly I could potentially have two fantastic positions. I could potentially have neither position. There was nothing. I was not used to this. I like watching other people make high stakes, play high stakes games on Wall Street, but I personally, if you were, you know, you probably have noticed, I'm a lawyer. I am not a trader, so that was a little more risk than I was used to.
So things were still changing under your feet, even in Washington?
Oh, yes. Yes, they have.
When you took over Market Reg, what did you find and what were your priorities? What did you want to do?
Well, what I found was a really committed group of professionals who were very expert at what they did. I mean, I was very delighted to see that at the senior levels, the people were, again, very committed to what they were doing and very, very knowledgeable about the markets. I think I was actually surprised at how much they understood about the markets. And I think a lot of that came from the fact that they had just, they were in the final stages when I came here of Reg ATS. And I think there was a group of people in the division who'd spent a huge amount of time studying the markets, and the equity markets in particular, which, you know, so they were at least as far along, and probably some of them knew a lot more than I did about the equity markets, having spent as much time as I had on the fixed income side. Mm-hmm. And I think that was my reputation, too. They were saying, oh, she's okay, but she does she know anything about the equity markets? Which I did, but, you know, they were really... really had developed an expertise for that regulation. So, and I'm sure before as well. So I found that. And I guess my own priorities, again, having come from the street, I think everybody comes in. I think Richard Lindsay had a similar priority. Everybody over the years had come in saying we really have to do some sort of net capital reform, that the net capital rule needed updating.
Explain that.
Well, the net capital rule, we have a rule in place that, given sort of modern risk management techniques, was considered somewhat rudimentary or antiquated. We imposed high capital charges for securities positions that did not take into account things like portfolio margining and value at risk analysis and the like, and there was a lot of certainly a lot of people on Wall Street believed that the commission should be moving more in that direction, as the banks had done with Basel. And so there was a lot of pressure to do that. It's a very, very complicated issue. And we did ultimately make some very significant changes, but something that I thought would be easy was not easy, and I would say it took us nearly 7 years to do it. I think if I hadn't been here so long, it wouldn't have gotten done.
Huh. One of the things you did early on was, surprisingly enough, involve deregulation, derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that became an issue where there was some concern about the derivatives market, and it was essentially, I think maybe working with the CFTC or something like that, the sense was pull back regulation rather than put regulation on. Do you remember that?
Well, we worked our piece of, if you're referring to the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, obviously our piece of it was rather small because it involved mostly deregulating large parts of the CFTC's mandate. But there was also an interest, given some things that had happened before, in ensuring legal certainty for derivatives, which we strongly supported. And we worked on that. And we also wanted to make sure that it was clear that securities-based swaps were subject to the anti-fraud provision. So that actually, while the whole package was quite deregulatory, there was even some additional certainty that we were able to achieve with respect to derivatives that were securities-based. Swaps that were securities-based were subject to anti-fraud provisions. I don't think that had been, we thought it was clear, but it was awfully good to get it in the legislation. And then we, as you know, that where the commission spent a good deal of its time in that legislation was on the provisions relating to single stock futures.
Right.
But, you know, much of what was in the CFMA was consistent with what the commission's position had been in the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. So coming out of long-term capital issues and the like, you know, there was a feeling that, yes, there had been problems and that counterparties needed to have a better understanding about the risks that those that they were doing transactions with were undertaking and those kinds of things. But it was pretty unanimous, I believe, on the working group that that there was not support for regulating derivatives.
Was it the idea that widows and orphans aren't investing in...
Partly the understanding was that it's largely an institutional market. We hadn't really seen... I mean, we certainly occasionally you'll get some hiccups in the system, but that the concern... And obviously we should have, you know, some concerns about systemic risk, but to the extent that most or virtually all derivative transactions are done with counterparties that are regulated entities, such as broker-dealer affiliates or banks, that through the entities that we regulate, we could raise the standards to ensure that they understood the transactions, the exposures, what the exposures were of their counterparties. And I think we have seen through, you know, our focus on that area that there have been substantial improvements in the area of counterparty risk management.
And single stock futures went in with this, and you were saying that the SEC had a little slice of something.
Right.
Like this.
Right.
Was it the other way around for single stock futures? Who was leading on sort of putting that in place?
Well, it was part of essentially the CFTC bill. I mean, it was part of Commodity Futures Modernization Act. That was the part that the commission took, I believe, the most active role in. The reason being that we felt pretty strongly, and continue to, and the legislation reflects this, that that single stock futures are both a future and a security, because a future on a single stock is a substitute for the underlying security, and therefore, if it's not deemed a security and it doesn't come within the securities laws, then you have this sort of gaping loophole for all sorts of market protections like, you know, insider trading and manipulation concerns and the like. So we took a very active role in drafting that part of the legislation.
You can still sell the futures short, right, on a declining market.
Right.
Which you couldn't do with the securities.
Well, but we're working on the short sale issues were a bit less of a concern. And as you probably know, since then, we've done all sorts of short sale reform as well. So that's not what drove it. It was really more of the market integrity, insider trading, market manipulation issues. I don't think short sales would have driven the process.
The interesting part was the agreement to sort of split regulatory authority between the SEC and the SEC.
Well, we share regulatory authority.
How does that work? It would seem very difficult, I guess, from an outsider's perspective.
Depends who you talk to. I don't think it's actually been that difficult. I think that the futures markets may disagree, but for the most part, you know, for whatever reason, the product hasn't taken off that much, so I can't say we have vast amounts of experience, but a lot of the rules that, all the rules that were necessary to put the product into effect were ultimately completed and done. I mean, the regulatory framework is there. The product, so it may have been a little bit duplicative in the sense that they had to file it two places. I think the CFTC, some of the market rules wouldn't go into effect on filing here. You know, they were, I think we had to improve them, but in general, I don't think that has been the problem. The product hasn't taken off as much as people would like. Some people say it's because the margin is at options levels, not at futures levels. We're trying to address those issues and are now reviewing option levels on all products, you know, through portfolio margining analysis and the like. But, you know, I don't think it's been a major problem.
Something that it seems that really you spent a good deal of time with in one way or another is the idea of a national market system. The 75 Act, I guess, set up the idea that there would be this national market system. How much progress had been made when you came in 1998? I know you weren't there in 75, but what had been accomplished in the way of bringing the markets together?
Oh, I think a huge amount had been accomplished. I mean, I think we did have, you know, we had certainly achieved the early mandates, I think, of a national market system. We had multiple competing linked markets. You know, we had order handling rules. We had lots of things that had been put in effect over time, that all of which were, you know, consistent with the goals of the national market system. What happened was that many of those rules that had been put in effect were no longer made sense given advances in technology, so that the rules that were well-reasoned, you know, 30 years before, now were actually having a distorting effect. They actually were keeping some new entrants out of certainly like the listed market, you know, because you had an ITS system that all the, you know, listed trades went through for purposes of ensuring that you weren't trading through a better price in another market, for instance. But given the protocols of that system and the slowness of the system, if you were an automated market, you'd have to wait what would be viewed as an eternity to get a message back, whether, you know, to hear whether or not your, you know, your trade had been executed. So that was a major problem. It was, you now had mismatches in business models that the regulations were, you know, basically making it impossible for some to even enter the market. So we had to make changes. I mean, we were at a point where we were no longer sort of in a steady state. The status quo wasn't acceptable. We had to make some major changes. And whenever you make changes of that type that are that significant, you're going to have people who are disproportionately impacted given where they're starting from, whatever their current business model is. So it was a real challenge to do it. And it's something that you can understand why it takes about 30 years to address, because some parts of it aren't fun all the time. But I think, you know, I hope that as a result of that effort, we're now sort of at the new plateau, you know, the new place on which we're all going to operate and again be able to continue to further the goals of the national market system and have multiple competing markets with lots of different models and let the best model win.
Well, you've sort of jumped through the whole process, but I want to talk about the process a little bit. Obviously, you had to tackle this in pieces. Do you recall what kinds of steps you took during your time in market regulation to address this? Regulation ATS, for example, was that already in when you came in?
Yeah, I was in the chairman's office when it was approved, so I really came at the tail end of ATS. Obviously, ATS was very important. You know, what it's hard for me to think back on all that we did, but when I started with Arthur, one of the things that we really did was push the New York Stock Exchange to eliminate its rules. I'm going to forget the number. Rule. This is funny. They had a rule that required that all trades in listed securities be done on an exchange.
390.
Yes, I was saying 415. No, it's not 4. 390. 390. How could I forget that? So rule 390, through a tremendous amount of cajoling by the commission, was repealed. And that was absolutely the right thing to do in terms of basically saying that you couldn't force all listed securities to be done on an exchange. But the issue now is that, well, what happens next? You know, there was a benefit to sort of ensuring that people were having order interaction in some venue and that we weren't encouraging internalization, by repealing Rule 390. So we decided to go out with the concept release on market fragmentation, which was sort of the beginning of the dialogue of what does this all mean as we change these rules? What is the impact going to be on the market? Is fragmentation a problem at all? Is this something we should be worried about or not? And what we did was we said, if it's a problem, there are a variety of alternatives that the commission could consider. And we had six different ways that if fragmentation were a problem, we said, well, what about these ideas? And we threw out lots of ideas. They weren't all novel. I mean, if you looked back at the legislative history going back to the 70s, some of these ideas had been considered then, but sometimes, you know, old ideas in a new context make sense, so we threw them all out. And started out with sort of what we saw as the most benign thought, which was, well, how about if we just have better transparency about the execution quality, essentially, all the way to, well, what if we make all orders come together in some sort of virtual limit order book? There were some who read that concept release with great trepidation because they viewed it as the commission's first move towards a CLOB, a central limit order book, which really wasn't certainly wasn't the staff's intention at all. It was just to put all the ideas on the table, but merely raising the dialogue had some people absolutely crazed with concern. Where we ended up ultimately was, as you know, we certainly ended up implementing the first of the thought pieces, which was that we implemented execution quality disclosure statistics, which I think have been amazingly powerful tool in having brokers assess, you know, the quality of executions that they're receiving at different market centers. So that was a very good result. But this is, as you know, then we started having, you know, some in the markets who said, you know, that they thought more centralization of orders would be a good thing, and others who were terribly concerned about it. So there was lots of permutations in terms of how we were going to go about addressing these things. But ultimately, as you know, we ended up with Reg NMS, because as we continued to have, you know, roundtables and hearings and outreach with the industry, there were some primary areas of focus that kept emerging. You know, that subpennies were a problem, that you know, that access, you know, that basically in today's world, you know, you should be able to access other markets without going through a central pipe. You should be able to do it sort of on a point-to-point basis, you know, through various internet-type technologies, and therefore if you had access standards as opposed to a central point of access with a single point of failure, that would be a modernization step that we needed to take. Obviously, the trade-through rule had caused problems, again, because of this notion that it didn't work in a world in which you had some people executing transactions in lightning speed and others who, you know, were waiting to get back to you in a minute and a half at that point. So we needed to address that. Well, yes. Some were doing it in sub-seconds. And then we had complaints about the market data system, not all of which have been resolved, but a small subset of which was addressed in Reg NMS. So it was a very iterative process, but as it should have been. I mean, these were very, very complicated issues. We really needed to get sort of consensus on, of all the things that people are complaining about, what are the most critical things to address? How can they be packaged, you know, in one document that, you know, will achieve the goals that we're, you know, trying to achieve? And then, as you know, we put it out a few times to really vet it as much as possible to try to avoid any unintended consequences. And now that it's you know, the commission approved it, we're in the implementation stage. Right. So it's very exciting.
Where was the resistance coming from? Was it coming from the markets that didn't want to lose their sort of exclusive turf? Or I'm just wondering, because there was some substantial concern about trade through,
right,
things like that.
Well, I don't want to characterize exactly, you know, where the camps were, because the people were all over the lot. I think there were some people who didn't want an order protection rule merely because they thought it wasn't necessary, that the markets would migrate that way in any case. And it was more of, I said to some of them, it seemed more like religion to them. But there were some people who were opposed to it. In fact, I believe, had their systems programmed to achieve that, essentially. So it wasn't a question that it was going to break their model or be of inconvenience to them. It was more that they would have done it anyway, and now that it was a rule, they would be audited on it, and that they'd have to defend their actions and that kind of thing, which is, you know, it's true that there will be some surveillance of it, so that, you know, it is more of a burden. But we didn't believe that everyone would do it uniformly, and that basically where we'd come out was that, given all the improvements in technology, the fact that you could program systems now to say, if a quote is immediately accessible, you know, in less than a second, why shouldn't you use all that computer technology to go get it? You know, that kind of thing. So that's, so we obviously on balance thought that, and the release speaks for itself in that regard, thought that there were public policy benefits and benefits to investors of requiring it. But I think the irony of it all is that, again, now that it's been done, obviously we still haven't implemented it, but I think people are somewhat calmer. I don't think that I think, as with many things, people, they argue up to the last minute that they want it to be differently, but I don't hear very many people saying today that it isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, they're saying, well, I would have been happier if I didn't have to do it, but you know, we're obviously hoping to make the implementation as seamless as possible so that they'll be able to do it.
And that sort of thing's happened a lot of times with the SEC.
Yes.
Right back to you.
Well, and as you know, I've given speeches on that. It's rather ironic that, you know, sometimes I would gain strength by, you'll appreciate this, going back in the history and looking at what people said about similar circumstances. I did give a speech last year before Reg NMS was approved by the commission that spoke exactly to that issue. We'd gone back and looked at other situations like, you know, when, you know, the we banned fixed commissions, and we got letters saying that grass would grow on Wall Street, and we looked back at some of the comment letters on the order handling rules and other things where people who are now the biggest advocates of those rules were people who literally said, you have no idea what you're doing, you're going to bring, you know, the capital markets to a grinding halt. And, you know, maybe we've had a pretty good run of it, and I hope I hope we'll be, you know, laughing about some of the comments in this case as well. But it does go to show that, you know, we truly have to be dispassionate. We have to take all of these comments very, very seriously, and we have to, and we do. But that ultimately we have to use our own expert judgment, because what we bring that others don't is hopefully some objectivity. We are not trying to protect our own models, our own profitability. We do have this overlay of investor protection, keeping in mind a responsibility to ensure that the benefits of what we're proposing exceed the costs. But you know, so sometimes we do come out with different, you know, in a different way than people would like. But ultimately, I think those who are the real visionaries in the business, and I think there are, fortunately, a lot of them, say, you know, for some reason, whenever we fight these things and then they go into effect, often what happens is the better the marketplace, the more business for everybody. Like we somehow have benefited, you know, that you know, spreads come down but volumes go up, that kind of thing, you know. So so I like to think that that will continue to be the case.
And once the rules are in place, the people in the industry learn how to.
They learn how, exactly. And I do think that there were some elements of NMS where clearly with the order protection rule, there will be some, trading will adapt to that rule. It will change a bit. Mm-hmm. The way block orders are done, like, will change a bit. And so I think people were saying, well, you know, I don't want to change. But they also knew that they'd have to change and really didn't like it with decimals as well. Much harder to find liquidity, you know, and the like. But they have adapted. It was painful. They didn't like it. Some people still don't like it. But the fact of the matter is they learned to adapt to, you know, a trading environment where there was a lot less liquidity at every price point, and they figured out how to do that.
Is decimals better for the investor? Is that why make that switch?
Well, I think decimals are just logically, you know, in a world of trading where, you know, every other jurisdiction trades in decimals and not fractions, to a large extent, it makes sense. And obviously, it did narrow spreads because, you know, it's a lot easier to trade, you know, in pennies, and you don't have this artificial eighth or sixteenth spread. That having been said, I think it was good for retail investors. I think it has made it a bit harder for institutional investors, and part of what you saw in NMS was a response to that as well. I mean, it definitely was harder to find liquidity in size, and that's, you know, part of what people were complaining about. And some of this notion of how do we get more people to show what they're willing to trade at, you know, put up more limit orders in hopefully somewhat greater size, came out of that decimal experience, and you see it reflected in where we came out in NMS.
I'm going to back up just a little bit and talk in broader terms about the commission. When Harvey Pitt came in, did the tenor around the commission change?
Well, I think it changes with every chairman. Of course, I was a staffer.
Right. How much does it change?
Well, there's always a lot of consternation. It's funny. It may be partly because, again, I came from Wall Street where we started talking about there's always quicksand under your feet, you know. I was more used to that. But I think longer-term staff at the commission, you know, they don't like that disruption as much for the most part. And there is some uncertainty over, you know, what is our mission, but what's the tenor of our mission. Because the staff really does want to serve the wishes of the commission, and particularly the chairman. And so you know, you get some chairmen who are more activist than others or more enforcement-oriented than others. I mean, they have certain priorities, and they sort of eagerly await, you know, the message from on high in terms of what is the tone, what's the tone that's being set at the top. With Harvey, it was interesting because I think, you know, he had been a defense lawyer, and I think the initial impressions that people had was that he came in being more critical of what the staff had done in the past or its enforcement efforts. And but it was interesting to watch, and now that I've been here through several chairmen, I think you see it. I've seen it more than once, where I think once you get to sit in that important chair and you look at the facts as the staff is looking at the facts, and it changes your tone because you realize where they're coming from, all the things that they can't say publicly as to why they've done what they did. And I definitely felt that was the case with Harvey. I think he's a very, very bright man, and when he looked at the same information that others did, I was amused sometimes that he would be more passionate than we were. You know, he saw things very much the same way, but again, and it was very different from what I think people had as the first impressions of where he'd come out on things. I think he was very balanced, he was very thoughtful. And again, I think what's been gratifying to watch is that each person, as they come in to that job, you know, they come in with tremendous speculation with the press on where they're going to be and what everything they've said in the past is going to mean for how they view things. And maybe it's just the importance of the position. I mean, maybe it's like being on the Supreme Court or something. You know, we always laugh at, again, you read in the paper how people say you can't predict where justices are going to go as well. I can understand why that is, because it's when you are actually in that spot and you feel the responsibility of the position and you see the facts, you know, really laid out, all sides, and you try to weigh them, I think it changes what would have been your, you know, knee-jerk cocktail party reaction before it was on your watch.
But did Harvey Pitt, in fact, take another look at enforcement when he was the chairman?
Oh, I think he was very interested in enforcement matters, and I think he was, I recall a few times, and I know people have said this publicly, that he was very hands-on, and he was, you know, a very good writer and used to editing work, and so I don't think the staff was used to getting, you know, such a hands-on chairman with his own marginal notations to the extent. I think there was one order that he wrote himself. He sent Steve Cutler the first draft, and it was like, oh my God, who's reporting to whom here, you know? You know, it's not like getting a draft from another staffer, you know, how do you... Now, can I comment on this? Can I go back? So I think he was very good at, again, giving the staff an idea of where he wanted to be procedurally on things, the kinds of messages that he wanted to send, you know, when he wanted to do 21A reports, when he wanted us to do a formal order, even when we didn't necessarily need it. I recall some instances with the SROs where I was used to just, you know, and still do, you know, if you ask for information, they willingly give it, but he wanted, just in case there was any problem, he wanted to have the order in place, so if he needed to use that subpoena power, he could, you know, that kind of thing. And so he had, you know, definite ideas about, you know, process and things like that, but was excellent at conveying it. People really knew, you know, he didn't like a lot of footnotes. There were certain ways he wanted things expressed, very, you know, plain English, accessible language. And it was amazing how, you know, he was good at letting that be known, and you really started to see, I know it really affected how we, you know, would respond.
And again, when Donaldson... Mm-hmm. Is there yet another change of focus, perhaps?
There's always some change. I mean, certainly, you know, from my own experience, and I see everything through sort of my Martin Reg lens, what was great was that he was well equipped to consider those issues. He had probably the best market experience of almost anybody that I had worked with. But he really wanted to consider the issues before he did anything. So he spent a good deal of time. It wasn't really delay, but it was done at towards the end of his tenure, and that was partly because earlier on he was really sort of considering the issues himself, studying it, and getting comfortable with what the staff was proposing. He knew it was extremely important, and he would ask sort of very incremental questions along the way, and then we would try to discuss with him, make sure he was comfortable. He'd really want to understand in a very granular way how we got to where we were, which I thought was fantastic. And once he got comfortable, and, you know, that took really several months of work on his part, then he was ready to go. Then he was convinced that this was the way to go. But it was interesting. I mean, he literally started off, when I say, you know, going back to square one, I think he started off with several conversations with me on what was my philosophy of regulation, what were we trying to achieve, what were the different ways that people could go about it. I mean, you know, it was really, I don't think people fully appreciate the level of his interest and involvement at that level, because he really did understand how important it was, and that was wonderful. And I think what was unfortunate when Harvey was here was that he didn't. I think he would have liked to have done that. He didn't have the time. He just, it was such an overwhelming period with Enron and WorldCom and the like that. On several occasions he said to me, I really want to, as he should have, I really don't want to move ahead with this until I can feel that I really understand the underpinnings of it. And I just need to have the time to do that. And the time was just very precious given all the other problems. So it was really thrilling when Bill Donaldson, was able to finally turn to it and really focused on it. And I felt very good about having somebody like him that, who had the experience that he had and had, such a good sense of the markets. I felt that if he, and the other thing that made me comfortable was that I knew that he always had lots of people that he sort of grew up with on the street who, I have no doubt he would bounce things off of. I don't know exactly who he talked to, but I'm sure that there was some bouncing of ideas here and there. I would assume so. And so I think it was a good test, but I think,
he wasn't bouncing to the extent that Harvey Pitt was bouncing.
No.
Bouncing
from
his back.
No.
Something I want to touch on before we start to wrap up is the NRSROs. That's another thing that you were involved in this period that we're talking about.
Right.
Where did that come from? That issue has been up and down at various times. I wonder what spurred it in the early 2000s.
Well, the issue is it's a complicated one because NRSROs, or Nationally Recognized Statistical Rating Organizations, is really a term that original purpose was only to be used for the net capital rule. It was really very narrow usage. It was intended to identify those rating agencies whose ratings were so recognized by the marketplace as having integrity and were so widely used that an investment grade rating of one of those entities on a debt security would mean that you could get a better capital treatment than you would have had did it not have that rating. So, for instance, if you had a bond with a AAA rating from S&P, the capital charge that you took on the position would be less than if it didn't have that rating. It's very simple. But it turned out to have captured the attention of others because it turned out to be sort of a proxy for a reliable rating. And so it ended up being used in other commission rules, including, you know, when you could use an S3, if you had debt securities out there with that were rated by an NRSRO, it ended up being used in foreign statutes and in state statutes, but it never had an infrastructure internally. I mean, for the little purpose that we had it for, I guess originally in Market Reg many years ago before I came here, you know, it wasn't that hard to apply, and we didn't worry about it quite as much. But then when you went further, you know, and it ended up taking on this great meaning, there were people who wanted, you know, they wanted the designation because they thought it was an entree into the business and all sorts of things. So it got a lot of attention. But where it particularly got attention by Congress was because as we had some of these problems, WorldCom and the like, you had folks in Congress and others saying, well, why did these rating agencies, why were they laden downgrading those securities and the like? And people were, so they were conflating this NRSRO issue with a separate issue of should the commission be regulating credit rating agencies. And they thought because we had this term NRSRO that we did regulate them. All we were doing was using that as a proxy for, you know, that this is a widely accepted rating. But having done that, some say that it started to take on, because of the wide usage of the term, it started to take on almost a seal of approval type connotation, which is why we are now trying to be more transparent about what it means to be an NRSRO, what it takes to be one, you know, those kinds of things in the rule. It does, the proposed rule. What the proposed rule on NRSROs does not address directly, it does a little indirectly, is the broader question of what are the limits of the commission's authority with respect to these entities. And after a lot of legal analysis and debate, we, I think, determined, and I testified before Congress, that we really think that our direct authority over credit rating agencies is quite limited. And the kinds of things that Congress seems to be most concerned about, such as our being able to take enforcement action against rating agencies or holding them to particular standards and the like, really substantive regulation, we don't have direct authority for. And so if, I mean, it's a topic of great debate, but if Congress really wants us to take a much more active role with credit rating agencies, I think we would need more legal authority. Mm-hmm. So that's what that whole debate is about. Not clear. I mean, I think it remains of some concern. I don't know where Congress is on it, but I feel better knowing that we've laid the groundwork both in addressing the technical issues of NRSRO by having this proposed release out there, and also being on record as saying that we are at the limits. We believe at the limits of our authority, and if Congress would like us to do more, we need that authority. Because, unfortunately, by not having been as clear on it before, we would often get we would hear the frustrations of Congress as if we hadn't done something that we should have done. So I think it's more important to be clear on that.
Okay. Wrapping up, got another 10 minutes or so. That's okay. Regulation, NMS and SHO, two big things, came out, I guess, about the same time, right, earlier this year? Is that correct?
Yes.
And I'm wondering, why then? Was there something Was there some reason that these threads came together at that point?
No, usually it's just how where you are in the queue, frankly. I think it depends on, you know, what the commission has time to consider, and you know, Bill Donaldson had a very aggressive agenda, and so we and the commission has, you know, a limited amount of these major initiatives that it can carefully consider at one time. So I think that's just sort of where we fell into line. It was certainly even with Reg Show was something that we had been working on for quite a long time. And so I suspect that, you know, the staff might have been ready earlier, but that was where they were able to slot us in because of all the other Securities Act reform and Reg ABS, and there were lots of other divisions. And you may have noticed that there were a few mutual fund issues that got addressed in this period, which was really remarkable because, that, you know, after the mutual fund area being so quiet for so long, the thought that we were getting bumped in terms of commission attention because of the mutual fund area was just hard for me to believe, but that was the luck of the draw. But then fortunately it all got done, but I didn't always have that confidence that it would all get done.
How involved were you in the mutual fund issue?
Oh, very little. I mean, I was aware of it. There are a few things that sort of touched on market rig, but, you know, I like to tell people that I feel like I'm going back and revisiting the history now as a commissioner, because although I was here, you know, I was a little diverted on some of my own issues. And to the extent that some of the mutual fund rulemakings were also areas of some controversy, you know, I felt, well, I have my own battles to fight. The last thing they need is me opining on what they're doing, you know. But now, unfortunately, I'm supposed to have an opinion on everything, so.
Well, let's talk about the nomination. When did you find out? Do you remember where you were and what you thought?
What happened was I was called by Senator Schumer's staff to have lunch. And the purpose of the lunch was to discuss possible candidates for commissioner, which I was very flattered that they wanted my opinion. I didn't know quite why, but I said that was fine. And we got together, and they ran some names past me, all of whom sounded quite good, and I threw in a few more, and I thought that was that. And then about two or three days later, I got a call back from one of the staffers saying, well, something to the effect of, well, you know, thank you for your help, but the senator thinks that there was an omission on your list. He thinks that you should be considered. I was a little incredulous for a variety of reasons. I mean, I really sort of felt, frankly, I was considering, after being here for over 6 years and having, as I like to say pejoratively, trained three or four chairmen, that maybe I was ready to move on to something else. And this was really a shock. I mean, it just wasn't what I was thinking about. I was thinking that maybe it was time, again, just because you do have to, even though I said earlier I like change, there's a point where you say, well, if I'm going to change, maybe I should really change and not just switch gears in terms of... Well, I don't think, I wasn't thinking of moving. I decided that this was a great place to live, and I really hadn't looked, but I was just thinking that maybe I should be thinking more expansively than just staying at the commission. But, I mean, I wasn't opposed, but it was not something that I'd considered. And so that was a surprise, to say the least. And then I thought, frankly, having just come off, you know, a rather controversial time, you know, I mean, I didn't think it was devastatingly controversial, but you know, I'd worked on some initiatives that had gotten some attention, that it was unlikely that the person who was put on the commission would be somebody with a history. And I also, frankly, feared that to the extent that there was controversy on any of these commission mandates, that my nomination would be an opportunity to reopen all of those debates. And that's what I said to Senator Schumer. And he was completely unfazed by it. He didn't think that that would be an issue at all. I said, well, that maybe not, but I thought it was a good enough chance that he should really consider it and consider going with somebody who, you know, really just wouldn't generate the same attention. I said I was a complete open book. You can look at the speeches I've given. You can look at the rules I've done. So I said, you know, it's possible that anybody who didn't like where we came out is going to say, well, we don't want her, you know. And but I think, frankly, what happened was when Chairman Donaldson decided to leave and there was a Republican chairman slot available, that it became very easy to package. And it was very gratifying that, you know, regardless of where people had come out, but, you know, everybody may not have gotten everything that they wanted in prior rulemakings, that the general consensus of what I was hearing was that they knew where, they knew where I'd stood, and they sort of respected the process, and they thought I'd understood the process, and that, and I guess they agreed with what some of the folks on the Hill were saying, was, which was that this was a very important time for the markets, and that it would be helpful to have somebody on the commission who had an understanding of the markets and was not, you know, someone who just, and I don't want to say that pejoratively, but just came out of a law firm or didn't have Wall Street experience. And so I think it worked out pretty well. Yeah. Surprising to me.
I did see the phrase lightning rod attached to your name.
You know, that was attached, although I have to tell you that was not my experience. That's what was so funny about it, that I learned through this process, although I'd certainly been covered by the press before, that the press was actually looking, I thought, to create controversy. I felt like I was reading about somebody else's life, because in actual fact what I felt was happening was much less controversial and more seamless than what was being described. It was almost as if the press was hoping for a story and they were trying to create one. In fact, the day that one of the most negative stories ran was the day that the White House said they were absolutely moving ahead. And it basically, as much as said, you know, the stories were making it sound like it was as much as dead. Everybody had it on good authority. So you realize that there was there may have been one or two people who were, you know, thought if they said it, it would become so, you know, that kind of thing. But I would say, given how these things go, and not that I have a lot of experience with it, but it seemed to me to be pretty straightforward.
Yeah, well, surprising.
Yeah, it really did. But again, I think a lot of it was, the fact that there was now something to move, you know, that there was a new chairman, I think I'm sure made a difference. I think if it had just been one slot, it may have been a little slower. So.
Well, you've got a new chairman,
yes.
New commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
How many meetings have you been in now?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. I mean, several. I mean, we have one closed commission meeting a week.
Okay.
And then we've only had one open meeting, I think, so far. We've had an appeal from an ALJ decision, which was open. We've certainly talked quite a bit, but...
How's it going?
I think quite well. I think Chairman Cox is really making a very good effort to have all the voices be heard, well in advance, so that we can, you know, work towards consensus to the extent possible. I think the dialogue's been, you know, very constructive. So far so good. It's funny, there are people who just really try to read commission tea leaves. You know, I mean, I literally have people commenting on body language and all this stuff that I just find amazing. But, I think there were some people who commented on how we were all chatting before the first open meeting, that was news, you know, that kind of thing. But I think, you know, in general, people just don't understand, you know, that how we all get along, and that if there are policy differences, it's not personal. You know, it's not certainly not intended to be personal, but so far it's worked out quite well.
Well, given recent history, I guess that would explain why there's this special interest in reading the tea leaves.
Right.
Well, what's on the agenda? Where do you think you're going to be going? You have two more years, right?
Right.
Definitely.
Well, I don't have my own agenda. You know, I do. If I have a personal agenda, it's to ensure that, you know, what the commission ultimately goes out with makes sense and is good from a public policy perspective, and is good for investors and the marketplace. Certainly, the agenda will be set by the chairman. I mean, my own, you know, personal interest obviously is seeing that NMS gets rationally implemented, but I also clearly have a lot of experience at the commission. I know how it operates, so fortunately I don't have a learning curve on how things get done. So my own view is that to the extent that I can be helpful in, you know, helping the staff communicate with the commission, you know, in all divisions, in, you know, bringing thoughts back to the staff that, you know, that are my own or that come from thoughtful people on the street, whatever, want to do that. You know, so I just am hoping to have a positive impact on sort of in general the operations of the place. And to the extent that I can do that, I think that would be a really major contribution, because in a large organization like this, particularly one that's grown so rapidly in such a short period of time, I think we, you know, as you'd expect, have some growing pains. And to the extent that you have a commissioner who is on the staff who understands the frustrations of getting things done, I always say it's a minor miracle that anything gets out of a building with this many lawyers in it, which I truly believe is the case. To the extent that I can move that along, particularly with my sense of time is money that I think I still have, that I think would be a very important contribution.
Well, great. Thank you for contributing to this project.
Thank you.
Is there anything else?
No, this has been great fun. Thank you.
Terrific.